pub. Independently owned and operated, featuring modern, independent, and classic films, microbrews, pizza, salads, and wraps. Located at East Burnside and 28th in Portland, 503-232-5511 or laurelhursttheater.com.
Welcome to an hour-long episode of the Film Show on KABU. I'm SW Conser. We'll be joined by Jen Chavez in just a minute. Today, we've got an amazing lineup in the studio. The Portland Film Festival is underway, and we'll be joined by the stars of two of the films, Bill Kelter and Wayne Schellebarger of Veeps, and Louis Ortiz of Bronx Obama. Plus, documentary filmmaker Andrew Walter will be on the line. And Jen will also be joined by David Walker, who will be appearing at the Hollywood Theater as part of the Movies in Black and White series.
First, though, Conch is joined in the studio by Angela Maddox, Artistic Director of the Time-Based Art Festival, as well as Mia Firm of the Cinema Project, to talk about film and multimedia presentations for this year's event.
And yes, thanks for joining us, Angela and Mia. And so we want to hear about this. TBA, Time-Based Art, is an annual event that's put on by PICA, Portland Institute of Contemporary Art. And every year you have a lot of visiting artists from around the world, performers, filmmakers, visual artists, musicians. And this year, usually as part of The Works, which is a late night series, you have a lot of multimedia and film presentations. Let's talk about some of the highlights that we're going to experience this year, and it's coming up in just a couple of weeks.
Thank you. Well, a pleasure to be here. Really happy to talk about TBA Festival in PICA. This year's festival runs from September 11 through 21, so it is just around the corner. And as you mentioned, we have some extraordinary visionary artists working in all different disciplines, both locally and globally, coming in to explore, I think, really current issues, ideas, and aesthetics. A couple of the projects that I'm super excited about that I think will be really interesting around the intersection of image, video, and film that I wanted to highlight. One is a project that really is a cornerstone project on our opening weekend. And it's an Inuit throat singer who's performing alongside of a seminal documentary film, which many people will be familiar with, Nanook of the North. It's a 1922 silent film. And Tanya performs with this, and she has this extraordinary, extraordinary voice. She's an Inuit throat singer. And so her approach is, it's rather primal and cathartic, and it's against this amazing Arctic landscape. You know, and a lot of the things I'm always looking at in terms of the festival, in this particular edition, issues around identity and cultural appropriation. So you have this extraordinary, fierce woman performing and kind of reclaiming this rather controversial silent film.
Yes, Nanook of the North. I remember seeing that as a kid back in school, and back then it was considered a documentary. And sort of in the same guise as a recent show that came through town, The Land of the Headhunters.
Mm.
It was shown to be, you know, a narrative was imposed on some of this footage by Western filmmakers. And yet there's a whole lot of beautiful imagery that is authentic.
Exactly.
That's part of the film.
Exactly. So Tanya is really, really interested in this in terms of, I mean, this footage of the Inuk people are her ancestors. And so it's both an homage. It's really extraordinary footage at the same time as you bring up really, you know, charged racial stereotypes, and as you have a Western, you know, cultural perspective, you know, documenting, and it's very controversial in that a lot of the scenes are staged and such. So it's both her a reclaiming of this as well as an homage, and it's really, it's a powerful, powerful piece to kind of launch our festival on Saturday, September 12th and 13th at PSU Lincoln Hall. So definitely a must see for our audiences.
Now, until I saw the TBA schedule, I had no idea that there were Inuit throat singers. Mm-hmm. I have some friends who spent years in Mongolia, and I know about the Tuvan throat singers, but not so much the Inuit.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, a great opportunity to see, actually. And Tanya is really, it's pretty amazing we have her. You know, I got to know her through the Kronos Quartet. She's performed at Carnegie. She's performed with Bjork. She's one of these amazing artists that we support at PICA who are not confined by one boundary and go into a lot of different sectors. We're really excited to bring her.
Well, what else is on the agenda for TBA?
Sure. Well, another project that I really wanted to highlight is a co-presentation with some of our friends at Beacon Sound. And this is a performance with live music, a brand new sound score, and new film. The two artists are Liz Harris, who's a local Oregon electronic artist, composer, vocalist. She's also known as Grouper. And she's paired with the filmmaker Paul Clipson. He's a San Francisco-based filmmaker. And this will also be just a one-night-only event. So, you know, it's always at TBA. There's so much to see, I know, but I encourage folks to really go to all 10 nights of the events. So this is one night only on Saturday, September 20th, also actually at PSCU Lincoln Hall. That hall really is a great venue for film and, you know, where people can really relax into it. The performance and film is really a landscape, an immersive landscape. The film is densely layered, has figurative and abstract environments in it, and it's going to be a really phenomenal, you know, again, pairing between film and vocals.
Well, Lincoln Hall is a big space, but people still might want to look into advance tickets.
Yeah, especially with Liz Harris. You know, she's has a phenomenal following. And again, this is a U.S. premiere. Mm-hmm. This project's never taken place in the United States, and so we're really excited to support it.
All right. Let's see. Anything else that's of note in the film and multimedia world?
Yeah. Well, I definitely want to highlight one of our cornerstone visual art projects. You know, we have an amazing visual art curator named Kristen Kennedy, and she's pulled together a really fantastic lineup of visual exhibitions.
She's a friend of the show. She's been on before.
Absolutely. So one of the highlights is an LA-based artist. Her name is Jennifer West, and she's creating a brand new immersive installation that will be one of the cornerstone projects at the works location that you referenced earlier. And it's going to run for through September 11th through the 30th. And what Jennifer's doing, it's really kind of an homage to the loss of celluloid and film. And she's created this immersive cinematic installation in which audiences can actually go into it. There's film strips, you know, scratched up films, and it's really participatory and immersive. And as well, there'll be a couple of nights where there'll be live music and dance within this installation. So again, you know, I think it's really a perfect TBA project that really exemplifies, you know, what's happening with the film industry right now, what's happening with form, and as well is incredibly immersive as both an installation and a performative environment.
Well, that ties in with a theme that the film show has been doing a lot of this past year, the end of film, so to speak. We did a two-part series on going digital or going dark, and we've also had folks who are still working with old 35mm and 16mm film prints, mm-hmm. as well as the digital prints that are going on these days. So this is going to be an interesting study of what is changing right at this moment, this
year. Exactly. Well, as always, you know, we're trying to do at PICA is really identify, you know, who are the leading artists and the visionary artists working right now locally and around the world, you know, investigating key issues around form, aesthetics, and ideas. And this range of projects, I think, really represents that.
Well, great. Well, we have another guest in here, and she has Mia is part of the Cinema Project Collective and has a major presentation at TBA this year. And Mia Firm, welcome once again back to the film show.
Thanks. I'm really happy to be here and always happy to be part of the Time-Based Art Festival. So I'm glad that you guys brought up this idea about continuing to champion celluloid, 16mm, 35mm. The program that we have put together, that Cinema Project has put together for the Time-Based Art Festival, is called In Favor of Skepticism. And it's on Monday, September 15th at 10:30 p.m., and that's part of the works. What we'll be doing is we'll be having a performance of original script by Guy Debord. The script is for a film called Hurlement en faveur de Sade, which is Howlings for Sade, referencing the Marquis de Sade. And it's going to be performed by a local artist and poet, musician, Noor Mubarak. She was actually part of a literary journal that was able to produce the first English translation of this original script just back in 2009. And what she'll be doing is reading the script, which is on two columns. One has a a transcription of what is happening on the image track of the film. And on the other column is a transcription of what's happening on the soundtrack. So she'll be using visual cues and hand signals, things like that, to give the audience an idea of what's sort of happening in the film, but in a very performative way. Following Howlings for Saad is going to be a film by a letterist filmmaker who's still alive. His name is Maurice Lemaître, and the film that we'll be showing is from 1970. It's called Toujours à l'avant-garde, de l'avant-garde jusqu'au paradis et au-delà, which translates to forever and ever, the avant-garde, just to heaven, something like that. Excuse me. Ever the avant-garde of the avant-garde till heaven and after. And part of this film will be sort of a live and recorded translation of the French spoken word on the film track. So this is where we would encourage audience members to participate either by adding in their own translations, yelling at the screen, just sort of having remarks, which is very much part of what the letterist film movement and literary movement was about that started in the 1950s.
Yeah, this ties in with a lot of what PICA and TBA really, really stress. Well, there's, of course, text, which is a big theme that runs through a lot of events, but also just, you know, this whole idea of things unfolding. You know, it is time-based art, and there are performance, there's film, there's all of these things that run on a schedule, but you're mashing them up in such a way that really kind of anything could happen, and the audience really has a part in directing which way things are going to go.
I'm glad you brought that up. It's one of our things that we think about a lot is the role of the audience member, and many of the projects are immersive. There's opportunities to engage and really rethink the relationship between performer and audience.
Yeah, so Mia, again, you're going to be September 15th, Cinema yep. Project is going to be doing these performances.
Yeah, and it's a one-night-only performance on the 15th, and this is actually the opening program for Cinema Project's fall season. We have two other programs in September. One's a fundraiser at Holocene on the 24th, and then we'll have a Maya Deren double feature at Hollywood on September 29th. So look out for our new print calendar, and our website has some information about all of those programs.
Maya Deren being the groundbreaking artist of the 40s and 50s.
Absolutely.
Who did a lot of Freudian stuff. I went to Haiti.
Yeah.
Some incredible work.
So we'll be showing actually a new print of Divine Horsemen, The Living Gods of Haiti, on the 29th. So that should be really exciting.
And your schedule is available at cinemaproject.org.
Correct.
Okay. So Angela Maddox,
yes.
Please tell us how listeners can get in touch with the TBA Festival folks, how people can get advanced tickets, find out more about PICA.
Sure. Well, PICA.org is your go-to place to find the entire festival lineup. I also encourage people to visit our office. We are located at 415 Southwest 10th Avenue, and that's also where our central box office is located this year. So we definitely encourage people actually to come in person, buy passes, tickets. We're open daily. Come visit us. Staff is there to help you navigate your festival experience. Again, you can buy passes online or individual tickets as well.
Now, is the box office open already, or is it going to be?
Yeah, the box office is currently open.
Oh, fantastic!
Yeah,
so people can go down. And
it's
check
time.
It out.
Yeah, absolutely. And some of these shows are definitely starting to sell, so we want to encourage you to get your tickets and/or passes soon.
And people can Google PICA TBA for the schedule of events.
Yeah, just go to PICA.org, and it's all listed right there.
Well, thank you so much, Angela Maddox and Mia Firm. It's fantastic to have you in the studio. And in a few moments, a little ways down the line, we're going to be talking with folks from the Portland Film Festival. But first, we're going to swing it out to Jen in just a moment. She's got David Walker in the studio to talk about movies in black and white. It's a new series coming up at the Hollywood Theater. All righty.
'89, the number, another summer. Sound of the funky drummer, music. Welcome back to the Film Show. I'm Jen Chavez. Now I'd like to turn our attention to a new and upcoming film series at the Hollywood Theater, Movies in Black and White. This series, hosted by writer and fellow radio host Jason Lamb, intends to bring people together to watch movies and talk about race, featuring guest panelists from the world of film, art, and comedy. The series' inaugural screening will feature a 35mm print of Spike Lee's 1989 classic Do the Right Thing, which explores simmering racial tension in Bed-Stuy of Brooklyn, New York, on the hottest day of the year. The guest panelists who will be there to facilitate discussion of the film are writer and filmmaker David Walker and writer and comedian Sean Jordan. It'll screen on September 22nd at 7:30 at the Hollywood. David joins us now live in the studio. David, thanks, and welcome back to the Film Show.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
So David, you're a filmmaker, you write extensively about film, and you're known particularly as a historian of black film to the degree, in fact, that you curate the Portland Black Film Festival, which we've covered on the show before. I wonder what you can say about what you find compelling about film in particular as a venue for exploration of race, either as a mode of expression for a filmmaker or a lens with which to examine ideas as the viewer.
Well, I think it's really good as a lens to examine ideas, but also as a lens to examine sort of how we've become who we are in this country. And, you know, film, when it was Thomas Edison, who was a pioneer of film, he was also not a very good person either, but he was a pioneer of film. And he was famously quoted as saying, whoever controls the film industry controls the greatest means of influencing the people. And I believe that. And you know, film came along at a time, you know, in the early, late 19th century, actually, and in the early 20th century, and it shaped how we see ourselves, how we view our society, how we view ourselves as Americans. And none of what it showed was actually real. It was this artificial construct, and it happened to be pioneered by people who were actually very racist and very just not good people, D.W. Griffith and Thomas Edison amongst them. And so now when we, you know, part of this program that Jason's put together, Film in Black and White, is to look at like just sort of the differences in how we see movies on a racial level, because it's very, it's just kind of amazing, really, when you sit down and talk to people. I mean, we think it's amazing how much just politics divides people. You can get divided by film, and film Absolutely. Is just, it's an extension of our political, it's just an extension of ideology. That's all politics and all of it. It's all ideological constructs.
Great. So the film in particular you're going to be discussing at the Hollywood is Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing. I don't think it's an understatement to call it one of the most respected films on racial issues of all time. It certainly established Spike Lee as one of the foremost modern black filmmakers. Personally, it's one of my all-time favorite movies. So I want to hear about how you feel about the film, maybe what your favorite part is or what you remember seeing it for the first time.
Oh, man. Well, I enjoy the film quite a bit. I actually saw it when it opened in Portland in 1989 at the Guild Theater in the middle of the summer, and there was no air conditioning, so it was really hot in the theater.
Well, there you go.
And I had just moved back to Portland from New York City, so I was there during a lot of what motivated and influenced Spike at the time, the Howard Beach killings, and I believe Yusef Hawkins had happened at that point, and the Central Park Five, and the film was just, you know, it was as powerful then as it is now. And but it's interesting watching it because this is the 25th anniversary. That's part of the reason that we're showing it, is to look at it and look at it through the eyes of 25 years, you know, and sort of look at, okay, how have things changed? How have things not changed? And sadly, they haven't changed that much. I don't know what my favorite part of the movie is. I think my favorite part of the movie is now is just sort of reexamining like those characters and their motivations. And it seemed, you know, my idea of what the right thing was in 1989 is not necessarily the same as my idea of the right thing in, you know, 2014.
And, you know, you speak about this a little bit before about the
the kind of the whole point of this series is to contrast how different people see films about race. It intends to include Black and white panelists to discuss their perspectives on films about race and how they might be unique. I'm wondering how you think this film in particular may speak differently to people of color than to white people. And, do you think that for white viewers watching Black films or films about race from a place of white privilege necessarily changes the impact or message? And on the flip side, for viewers of color, does watching films about racial issues necessarily become about personal experience and identity?
Wow, that's a lot of questions there.
I'm sorry, that was like four.
That's okay.
Yeah, we can. But I guess how in particular reference to Do the Right Thing.
Yeah.
How do you think it might be seen differently by?
Well,
by
I think that film is and it's so relevant. Like, especially right now, we see what's going on, especially in a city like Ferguson, Missouri. And I think that with a film like Do the Right Thing, like, that film exposed a certain audience to a reality that they were completely unaware of. And of course, it's not real because it's a film, it's an artificial construct. But that idea of racial hostility in a neighborhood that is incredibly ethnically diverse, And the sort of those longstanding lingering hostilities, longstanding lingering misunderstandings, problems with the police, a lot of that, like, people just didn't know. They just didn't see. They didn't understand. And so a film like Do the Right Thing exposed a certain audience to that for the first time, whereas then there was another audience that was like, yeah, no, this is life. This is reality. You know, it was a couple of years later was when the Rodney King video came out. And that was also this sort of watershed moment where it was like there was a whole bunch of people in America that were like, this can't be real. And then there was this other group of Americans that were like, no, this is every day. This is the sort of thing that goes on. And that's the thing. And that's what's, you know, sort of amazing about Do the Right Thing. And then 25 years later is like, we're still having this conversation. Like, nothing has changed. It's like there are still people who, I remember coming out of the theater and there being arguments, and there were people who were more upset, spoiler alert about the movie if you've never seen it, there are more people upset that Sal's Pizzeria burned down than there were people who were upset that Radio Raheem was killed. And like the whole message was like, and that was this raging debate 25 years ago. And 25 years later, we're having this raging debate over, you know, when is it okay to shoot an unarmed person, you know, and it's really the same question, you know, it's the same burning topic. And so I think when Jason planned this event, he was hoping that we wouldn't get too deep and too serious, but we might get deep and serious. I don't know, you know, if we need to, we need to, right?
Absolutely. And it seems like something, yeah, with what's been going on in Ferguson, Missouri, might happen. I'm curious, have you watched the film since, like, in the last?
I haven't watched it in about 5 years.
Yeah.
I'm going to watch it again right before, probably a couple days before we do the screening, just to sort of familiarize myself with it. And I have a lot of, you know, and I know people are probably going to come out just because they know I've got issues with Spike Lee sort of on a much bigger level. But that film in and of itself is worth watching, worth revisiting and talking about. And again, and I think, and going back to, you know, your questions, you know, that was sort of the beauty of Spike Lee, was like his films, especially those early films, sort of introduced a wider audience to, now I'm not going to say the Black experience in America, but definitely Spike's view of the Black experience in America, which is, you know, just one person's. That's like, Steven Spielberg doesn't speak for all, you know, people who have to fight dinosaurs or anything like that, you know, so... but yeah, so I think that, and that's what film in and of itself does. It opens up people to ideas and concepts that they might never have thought of. And if those ideas and concepts help to ignite their humanity a little bit more, then that's a good thing, right?
Absolutely. It's interesting because your co-panelist for discussion of the film, Sean Jordan, is a comedian.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, Do the Right Thing as a dramatic film is very moving and gut-wrenching at times, but it also has a lot of very funny elements, particularly through the character Spike Lee plays himself, Mookie. What do you expect might be discussed about the film as a comedy, or about the effect comedy can have on looking at social issues?
Well, I think comedy is the most effective tool for looking at social issues personally. That's why I'm always cracking jokes. And I think that the film is effective as a comedy up until, you know, a very certain moment where it makes a turn. And I think that's what, you know, initially drove a lot of people crazy when they saw the movie. But to me, you know, when you ask me what stands out, you asked me earlier what stands out the most, the part that stands out the most will always be the three guys. It was Paul Benjamin, Frankie Faison, and Robin Harris, the three guys sitting outside on the corner. And it's like, to me, that was the most real part of the movie, but it was the most real part, period. It's like I grew up around guys like that. I saw that growing up as a kid, and I think that just even that speaks to something really interesting, because it's like, yeah, you know, that these guys do exist. You can find them in any, you know, black neighborhood, and this is, so in that regard, this is life, you know. That's as close maybe to real life. Well, I was going to say there's a lot of other aspects of real life that he actually did capture in that movie. But that to me is the part that's most memorable. And it's the, you know, like maybe the part, the reason it stands out the most is because it's like the least traumatic. At the end of the day, that movie's just about a series of traumas. And the only, you know, thing that seems even healing is that, are those three characters, to me anyway.
You know, you mentioned a little bit about how your perspective on Spike Lee may have changed since then. And you know, I'm curious to hear about that. And also, do you think that there are modern filmmakers who are doing, you know, the similar work to what he was doing with Do the Right Thing back in 89?
Well, I don't know if there's anybody. I mean, you know, I just there's a lot of filmmakers that are doing some really interesting things. They're not getting seen the way Spike's movies are getting seen. And they're not, and you know, and sort of the death of traditional video stores, that sort of stuff has made it more difficult. You have to search stuff out, whether it's on Netflix or some other streaming service. So I don't know. I mean, there's, you know, like a movie like Fruitvale Station is like really important, you know? But then I also feel like, you know, as the older I get, it's like the less I want to see movies about the horrors of the world and more about like trying to find ways to motivate us to become better people and find solutions. And so I don't necessarily need to see movies anymore, or as many movies that are like dealing with the horrors of America and what can be inflicted on people of color, because I see it every day in the news. What I'd like to see is I'd like to see film get back into an exploration of the potential of our humanity and our ability to come together. And I don't see, if there's films doing that, I'm missing it. I'm not seeing them. They're not being called to my attention. And that's sort of what drives me crazy, because it's like, well, if every movie we see is about whether it's tension between different races, ethnicities, genders, you know, whatever ideological constructs, then like, are there solutions in there? You know, like what we need to be seeing is how much we're the same versus how, you know, different we are, because the differences are negligible.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm kind of interested in you are also, you do comics.
Yeah.
And I know that in your wide array of film analysis, you've kind of explored like African American representation in sci-fi and like fantasy films or films about comics. Like, is there, you know, a way for genres that aren't typically considered to be about race to carry on this discussion in ways that dramas about, you know, serious social issues are not?
Oh, there's definitely ways to do it. It's just, are you willing to do it? You know, I mean, you could have, you know, take a movie like Guardians of the Galaxy, which everybody's loving, you know, and Chris Pratt does a great job as Star-Lord. But what if there had been a black actor in that part? You know, what if, and that's sort of the thing that we get into is like, there's all sorts of opportunities. But the most simple basic thing is like within sci-fi especially is like if you just have characters of color that are portrayed as just human beings, complex human beings, as opposed to the sort of stereotypes. I mean, that's why everyone loved Star Trek, you know, Deep Space Nine, because, you know, Sisko, why he's the best captain in the history of Star Trek. It's because like that's a really complex character. He happens to be a black guy, but it was like that wasn't, in the beginning, that wasn't first and foremost to his character. And then Avery Brooks made sure that there were some stories that were introduced that brought in those aspects. But yeah, you know, we need to have more than just Will Smith in a movie. You know, we need to have more than just Jamie Foxx in a movie. We need to have, you know, you know, the next time, you know, the next Avengers movie is still just going to have, you know, probably Samuel L. Jackson and maybe probably nobody other, no other people of color, male or female. You know, it's the same problem with women. And I mean, that's another subject. And the two go hand in hand. We don't have to, you know, separate them and go, how do we talk about issues of representation when it comes to, you know, gender? And then how do we talk about issues of representation when it comes to race? It's like, well, how does we talk about issues of representation, period? Because everybody's left out of the equation except for this one group. And we all know who that group is. Do I need to call them out by name on air? I could if you want to. White
sure.
guys.
Yeah.
Yes. So they are the gatekeepers. And yeah, and so that's what we need to do. That's what I'd love to see more of. You know, I'd love to see. And as a writer, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to create these stories with that sort of explore the complexity of who we are. And but when you're denied that, and that's the most important thing is we have to talk about what happens when you're denied that. When you're denied access to fantasy, and by fantasy, I don't just mean the genre fantasy, because film in and of itself is all just a fantasy. When you're denied access to mythology, because that's also what film is, it's a mythological, it's a modern day mythology, then you're denied access to how we explain our existence, right? And so I talk about this all the time. You can take a movie that's great, like The Princess Bride, which was one of my favorite movies of all time, and there's no people of color in The Princess Bride, right? What does that say? You
exactly.
know, all three Lord of the Rings movies, not a single person of color. That you can, you know, people, well, what about the orcs? Shut up. No, orcs are not people of color. Okay. It's not until this second Hobbit movie that there's a black person, actually a black person in a crowd scene in all of Middle Earth. So you're going to tell me in all of Middle Earth that there's, you know, that's it. But that, again, these are manifestations of our fantasies, manifestations of our mythology, manifestations of how we express who we are, for better or worse. And when you exclude people of color, or when you exclude women in roles of power and authority, then you're denying in real life, you know, people access to these constructs. And so that's what's really important to me.
Great. Well, David, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and your expertise. I've been speaking with writer, filmmaker, and film historian David Walker. The series Movies in Black and White kicks off with Do the Right Thing on September 22nd at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater. And you can find more info on the series Facebook page, Movies in Black and White, and on Twitter at No Color Movies. David, thank you so much for coming by the studios and joining us today.
Thanks. It's always good to see you guys. Ba 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 ba
Welcome back to the film show. I'm Jen Chavez. Now we're going to turn our focus to a film festival that's underway at this very moment, the Portland Film Festival. It's been going on for a couple days and will continue throughout the weekend. And we have several great filmmakers and folks involved with film that are going to be joining us for the second half of the hour. First off, I'd like to turn our attention to the film Unbreakable, a story of hope and healing in Haiti. It's a documentary that's going to be featured at Cinema 21 as part of the festival on Saturday at 2:20 p.m. I'm joined now by Andrew Walther, one of the producers of this documentary. Andrew, thank you so much for calling in and taking a moment to join us this morning.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
So this film follows a humanitarian mission in the aftermath of the catastrophic 2010 earthquake in Haiti. Can you talk a little bit more about the Healing Haiti's Children Initiative, the conditions faced when aid workers arrived in Haiti and what they set out to do?
Absolutely. You know, Haiti was already in 2010 ranked by a number of entities as the poorest country in the world and by everybody else as one of the poorest countries in the world. And when the earthquake hit in January of 2010, what little infrastructure there was in the capital, Port-au-Prince, became virtually non-existent overnight. And hundreds of thousands of people, I mean, as many as 100,000 people died. There were hundreds of thousands more that were left homeless. And what we would take for granted, like antibiotics, if you broke your arm or had a big gash in it from a falling building, were suddenly not possible. And so there were an enormous number of amputations of people's limbs to save their lives from gangrene and so on in the days after the earthquake. The U.S. came in with the military and helped set up a big hospital at the airport, and it was just a scene. Sort of right out of the apocalypse in terms of just a completely destroyed city, and people who had very little to begin with suddenly had nothing at all.
And what provided the impetus to begin, not only this humanitarian mission, the Healing Haiti's Children Initiative, but to begin a documentary project about it?
We got involved, the Knights of Columbus got involved with an organization called University of Miami MediShare, Project MediShare for Haiti. And they were running a major hospital in Port-au-Prince. And as we were looking to do something, we do a lot of charity every year, and we were looking to do something to help the victims of this earthquake. We do a lot of disaster relief. And we partnered with Project MediShare to help especially the children who had lost limbs, because typically they were the last ones to be cared for. If someone had to get medical attention, the parents would get it first because they would then go out and work to support their kids. And so the kids were kind of getting left behind a little bit. And so our cooperation with Project MediShare allowed us to create a program where every child in Haiti who had lost a limb could come in and get a free prosthetic device, several pre-prosthetic devices over the course of several years, as well as rehabilitative therapy. And as we did this, we took some video initially when we went over there just to sort of record what was happening. But the story became really incredible, both the individuals involved who were recovering and what they did as a community. As they began to recover, they formed a soccer team. And in Haiti, it's really almost impossible to understand from our perspective, but there's an idea that if you've lost a limb, somehow there's a judgment against you from the cosmos or from the supernatural. Something has designated you as a bad person. And so this soccer team started playing soccer, getting attention in Haiti, and then told us they really wanted to do something to give back to America, because so much money had been raised on their behalf from the United States. The American soldiers had helped take care of them right after the earthquake. So a number of them asked if they could come over here, and we worked with them to help train American soldiers who had lost limbs primarily in Afghanistan. And so they came over to Bethesda, to the Army Hospital. They helped the amputee soldiers learn how to play soccer, and there were these people who literally had nothing, who were trying to give back in a way to the people who had helped them the most. It was really incredibly moving, and the story just sort of told itself, so we started recording, and it turned into, I think, quite a little documentary.
Yeah, and you speak about the soccer team coming to America and working with disabled folks here. How is the film applicable to disabled communities outside of Haiti? I mean, do you feel that aspects of the film are meant to be universal in their treatment of issues affecting disabled people?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Haiti was a very stark case of some of the challenges facing people with a physical disability. But what we saw when the Haitian team came to the United States and began working with the Americans who were disabled and learning to play soccer and really, I mean, we're talking in this case about young people who had been in Iraq, and I mean, we're talking people in their 20s and 30s who suddenly lost a limb and went from being incredibly active to seriously disabled. I think that the power of sports and the concern from other people with the same kind of disability really reaching out to try to help them, to really try to show them that sports could continue, that there was a real fullness to their lives that they could experience in playing sports in a way that they might have discounted. You know, my life is now this, but here were these young people from Haiti saying, look, you can play this game. They, you know, this is an international sport. Amputee soccer is something that is at the Paralympics. It's something that's played all over the world. And all of a sudden, these young people in the United States were being ushered back into the world of sports, which, as you'll see in the documentary, some of them had completely written off.
Excellent. Well, you know, one last question before we go. I'm interested to see this film is premiering, you know, this weekend, and it's been, you know, over 4 years since the earthquake in Haiti happened. Are there hopes that it'll draw attention back to issues in the region currently or work that's still being done there today?
Well, you know, Haiti needs a lot of help. There was a lot of money promised to Haiti right after the earthquake, and unfortunately a lot of that money for a variety of different reasons didn't materialize. And of course, we have a program there where we actually ended up putting more money in than we initially promised. But it's a country that still needs a lot of help. It's a country that still needs a lot of attention. I mean, it's kind of the forgotten country in the Caribbean and the Western Hemisphere in a way, because it's so poor, it's so impoverished, it has so many sort of systemic problems that people have to overcome. I think that if this movie can help raise awareness about both the challenges in Haiti and also the ability to overcome those challenges and create sustainable programs that are employing local people in Haiti, helping people who have had serious crises in their lives, like losing a limb, to help other people in the same kinds of positions, I think it's a really great opportunity for people to see the good that can be done even in the most dire circumstances imaginable.
Excellent. Well, we can look forward to seeing that film again. It will be screening at Cinema 21 this Saturday at 2:20 p.m. I've been speaking with Andrew Walther, one of the producers of the documentary, and thank you so much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thank you.
Now we'll go back to Conch with some of the filmmakers from the project Veeps, Profiles in Insignificance.
Thank you, Jen. We are in the studio here live with the two stars of Veeps, the movie Profiles in Insignificance. We've got Bill Halter and Wayne Schellebarger in the seats here. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello.
Oh, and we're also joined, and we're going to talk with Louis Ortiz in a moment. Louis is Bronx Obama. He is the star of Bronx Obama, the movie that's going to be playing during the Portland Film Festival. Welcome, sir. Welcome, Mr. President. Looking very presidential today.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me here in Portland.
So it's an all White House theme here, and we want to ask Bill and Wayne. So you are profiled in this movie. You have originally done a book called Veeps, and Wayne did the illustrations for it. Bill, you wrote it, mm-hmm. And you guys go around the country. You are absolutely obsessed by the office of the vice presidency.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were just looking for a better life. We were at that position in our lives where just looking to improve our station. The vice presidents have been a passion. Wayne and I had, for years been arguing in vice presidential chat rooms and competing with one another on eBay for vice presidential memorabilia. This opportunity coalesced during the 2008 election to follow the vice presidents around the follow the election around the country. And we had an opportunity to possibly get a job with the vice presidency, and we went for it, dove right in.
Gave it a shot.
I can remember a quote, and I can't remember who it was. John Nance Garner said, the vice presidency is not worth a bucket of warm spit.
That
he
was
didn't
one
say
version.
That.
Yes, a little saltier than that. Yeah.
So here you are, you're in 2008, and you're visiting both of the political conventions, the national political conventions for both
right.
the Democrats and the Republicans. Now, did you run into any actual vice presidents or vice presidential candidates, like, say, Sarah Palin? Was she running around doing...
Well, she hadn't been she was nominated while we were there.
The end
so
of the week, yes.
We were, along with the rest of the country, with our jaws on the floor, wondering who this person was. So mm-hmm. we did have a few days there where we didn't know who the vice president-elect was going to be, or nomination was going to be.
I had actually done on my blog, I had Veep Steaks Mondays leading up to it, and I had Sarah Palin was on the list, and I had her as a 30-1 30-1 against as of May, and then McCain pulled her out of thin air at that point in August. So.
And then you got blown off by Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney, yes.
Yeah.
You're a flesh and blood person and not a corporate person.
Yeah, yeah. He had an entourage, and he was not at a point in his career or life where he deserved an entourage, but he had one in Denver, and they looked right over our heads and walked right past us. And yeah.
I spotted him about 50 or 100 feet away or so, and so we thought, well, let's go and we'll just talk to him about it and see what he would do if he was vice president and that kind of thing, and thought he'd enjoy that. But I got the coldest blow off I'd ever encountered in my life from him. He's a pro.
Yes, and I think at that point, since they had their shortlist already narrowed down, I think he was pretty much done being vetted and well off the shortlist of vice presidential candidates. So just that.
He had no interest in being there anymore.
The suggestion of the vice presidency probably didn't sit very well with him that particular time.
So this is a documentary, but it's also a bit of a comedy on it's a bit of a Bill and Wayne's Excellent Adventure. And now, do you have any embarrassing moments like it getting shaken down by Secret Service or anything like that?
There have been times when people have called this entire project an embarrassing moment. But.
Yeah, it was. We were hoping to get at least some credentials to get into some of the meetings and press conferences and things like that, and kind of add our 2 cents to the whole thing, because we were best equipped to do that as far as the vice presidents went. But we couldn't get into anything. So we saw the whole thing from the sidelines. That was our perspective.
We were pretty much non-entities, but we thought, that's a very vice presidential position.
Yeah, it ended up working well for the whole thing because it was right in line.
Yes, very, very appropriate. So the world premiere of Veeps, Profiles in Insignificance, is happening on the 30th of August, Saturday the 30th, at the Portland Film Festival at Cinema 21, 11 a.m. People are going to have to get up early.
Best time for a comedy.
Yes.
Shake off their Friday night hangovers to come and
see. Or continue
it.
Them.
And there's more information at portlandfilmfestival.com, and that's where people can buy tickets, so it's ongoing right now. And Bill and Wayne, pleasure to have you here. I'm going to turn things over to Jen, and we're going to talk to Luis Ortiz.
Thanks, Conch.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
The star of Bronx Obama.
So, what do this? Jen, do I put this on?
Yeah. Hi there, this is Jen Chavez back on the film show. As Conch said, I am joined in the studio by Luis Ortiz, better known these days as Bronx Obama. Documentary about his work by the same name is playing as part of the Portland Film Festival, in fact, on his closing night at Waterfront Park. Luis, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show, and may I say you're looking very sharp today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's my first time in Portland. Super excited.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, I hope that you're enjoying it so far. And it should be quite a great experience having the outdoor screening on closing night. I'm looking forward to it. So can you talk about how things were in 2008 when you first realized you looked like Barack Obama and how it was that you first realized it. I think the assumption is that, you know, impersonators are professional actors who are banking on the fact that they kind of sort of look like someone, but maybe it's a stretch, but it doesn't sound like that's the way it happened for you.
Well, it's been a very long journey, you know. Believe it or not, I'm still learning. But being in this, you know, ever since I bumped into Ryan Murdoch and he started making a film about me, it's brought me to a whole different level of understanding the industry. You know, it's in the same realm, but it's just not, you know, you guys don't impersonate people. You know, you guys are the real deal. Filmmakers, me, I just got lucky.
Yeah, I think I was watching the New York, and it's very interesting, by the way, how this developed. First, it was featured on This American Life as an audio piece, then as a short documentary on the New York Times, and now a feature documentary. And I think you mentioned in the New York Times piece that you had a bartender say to you, like, "Hey, do you know who you look like?" It seems like it was kind of an accident, like the realization that you bear similarity to Mr. Obama.
Well, the way it goes, and I hope you guys can make it on Sunday for the screening at
Waterfront Park.
Waterfront Park.
Yeah, it's right at on the 5 waterfront.
PM. Yeah. Yep. But what happened was, you know, my friends were joking with me for a whole month, like, "Oh, you look like this guy that's running against Hillary." I'm like, "What? Okay, I've been hearing this since second grade. I got big ears, so what?" But then all of a sudden, I bump into this bartender, and he tells me, "Listen, there's a way to make money. You should take off your mustache goatee and take a look." Once I took a look, it got, you know, those jokes turned into seriousness, you know. Very, very serious. I did not own a suit before all of this. I did not have a passport. I was a regular Joe in New York, 9-to-5 guy. But in the middle of my 1 year unemployment, I discovered this look. And it's like the Germans say, I hit the genetic jackpot.
So I remember, personally, one of the most charming things about listening to the radio piece was hearing the evolution of your impersonation of his voice, which you've really honed since you started out. How was that for you, the process of developing that skill? Because that seems much more challenging than, you know, just, as you say, taking off your goatee, looking in the mirror, and buying a suit. Was that an ongoing process, a challenge to hone that voice?
Yes, yes. Especially when you got a... You got to hone in on different the different angles of how he speaks, because he has when he's speaking to a big crowd, you know, the whole Martin Luther King, like, "From the cornfields of Iowa to the front porches of Des Moines," you know. Then you have the one-on-one, like we're having right now. So what helped a lot was I stopped smoking cigarettes. That really helped. That really helped.
The professional advice for all voice actors and actors out there.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Well, you know, tell me about the tour that you've been going on with other impersonators, because I think that's featured pretty prominently in the film. You joined a Bill Clinton impersonator and a Mitt Romney impersonator. Is that right?
Yes. For a... it was a road... actually, we, Mitt Romney impersonator and myself, we did debates, comedy debates on the road. We actually did three debates before Obama's first debate. So I kind of like beat him to the punch and made a lot more people laugh than he did.
I'm sure.
But it's been good. You know, you bump into all kinds of situations doing what I do. You know, one day you're singing rap, you know, rap lyrics in a rap video. The next day you're shaking hands with the Dalai Lama. Like, I do the craziest things.
Oh, that's right. You did do a rap video, didn't you? Yeah. I totally forgot about that. That was awesome. Great. Well, I'm sure that listeners should probably run to YouTube and look that up right now. I want to know, like, what has the experience been like to have,
you know, people cheering or maybe even booing you on the street. Have you gotten used to that? And what are some maybe memorable experiences in particular that you've had in terms of people on the street approaching you and thinking that you're actually Barack Obama?
Doing this since 08, you get everything from all the way far left to all the way far, far right.
Right.
You know, you get racism, you know, you get a lot of love as well, though. It's I'm a lightning rod, I'm a lightning rod for the stuff President Obama really doesn't have to deal with, because he has his no people like get away from him, you know. I'm just a regular guy, so I'm walking down the street and you know it's not him, because I'm not surrounded by 8 Secret Service. So you kind of approach me and say, let me let this guy have it, since I can't let the real guy have it. Whether positive or negative, you know, it goes both ways. And one of the most memorable moments was I performed a quick little speech at a charter school in the Bronx. And it was a surprise visit. They had a third grade student government inauguration going on. And I walked in and these kids went crazy.
I'm sure.
They went crazy, but, you know, it wasn't like, oh my God. It wasn't just the oh my gods. It was this one little lady. She must have been like 7, 8 years old. And some lady comes up to me and says, could you please come take a picture? I'm like, yeah, sure. Come over. And this girl is hysterical crying. She's looking at me, holding her face, like, oh my God, she's crying and crying. And I'm like, it's okay, it's okay. That was like, you know, I from left to right, from positive to negative, that's gotta be one of my most, and even meeting the Dalai Lama and even hanging out with Steve Forbes, him asking me to dance with his daughter, you know, all that stuff does not compare to the tears of joy that this girl was experiencing just because she saw my face. It's crazy.
Yeah, that sounds pretty crazy. I want to ask about one more thing that I read in the Washington Post. I heard that you guys had some fun recently in Washington, D.C. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, we did AFI Docs, and as you know, you might know, the White House has a program called My Brother's Keeper. So they invited, I think, 40 filmmakers and one subject, me, into the White House. And I think they had my birth date wrong. So everybody's getting in. And as all the tourists are walking by, taking pictures of everything, I'm standing outside with my filmmaker trying to get in for an hour. So the whole big crowd comes around me, and then they rushed me back in. I get inside, we sat down, had a little conference. And then one of the staffers grabs me and says, look, let's go have a little fun. Let's just walk around from room to room and open doors and just say hello. So I did. As soon as you open the door, they see my face, and everybody just stands up like in a hurry. Everybody's just like, boom, stand up. Hey, Mr. President. And then I walk out, and the staffer is just cracking up. He's just laughing. I'm like, you're bad.
what was the balance of like the people who thought you were him versus the people who were like, wait, who is this? Who is this guy?
I think people that really thought I was him, because I had the right height at the time. I had my platforms on.
Interesting.
Yeah, I don't have them on right now. So I think it was like 75% really thought, and 25% was like, oh my God, this guy's funny. You know, but it was a lot. It was a lot. It's a lot of people.
Great. Well, I at least am looking greatly forward to seeing the film about, you know, your work and these experiences. Again, it's called Bronx Obama, and it's screening at Waterfront Park as the closing night of the festival on Sunday, beginning at 5:30. Is that? I think that's right. That's
what it's, five.
Five. Yeah, five. Five. I think. So,
yeah, 4:35.
4:30 or five. So.
Yep.
So.
you know, show up early if you want to get seats. It's going to be a showstopper. So anyway, thank you very much for joining us, Luis Ortiz.
Thank you so much, Jen.
I've been very pleased to have you. And thank you to all of our guests from the Portland Film Festival today. It's been quite a rollicking hour of radio.
Yes. Josh Leek, who's here in the studio. Thanks so much. PortlandFilmFestival.com. And we want to thank all our listeners, too, on the web and on the dial. And Luis Ortiz, yes.
I'm Bronx Obama.
You're Bronx Obama.
And I approve KBOO radio station.
Thank you so much. And the archived version of this audio will be available later today at kboo.fm/thefilmshow. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown Portland radio station.